divine abiding in joy and divine abiding in equanimity. These two qualities complete the four Brahma-viharas, Brahma-vihara, metta, karuna, mudita, and upekkha. When we intentionally practice them, we're learning to take rest. We're learning to find the kind of rest and relaxation that the connection of metta, and only the connection of metta, can provide. And to take that deep and profound rest of care and protection that only the compassion, the karuna, brahma-vihara, can provide. And to take that deep viveka, rest and relaxation in pure, unbridled joy. This appreciative consciousness and awareness that only this mudita, brahma-vihara, can provide. And taking rest in that wide mind, heart of balance, equanimity. The serenity, deep, peaceful serenity that's attuned to things as they are, that only the upekkha brahma-vihara can provide. So we've been learning to find our sanctuaries, our safe harbors, refuge. And when Michelle explained about bowing yesterday, You see it all the time in Asia, in India and Southeast Asia. On different levels, you see people do it, and you'll feel that they just are really doing it out of respect for their ancestral and teaching lineages. When you see it in monasteries, you can feel viscerally. You can feel it as a practice. You can feel people are genuinely taking refuge when they bow to what's called the triple gem, the awakening power within that the word Bud means, or Buddha. And Dhamma means the liberating truth. And Sangha, the close, compassionate community of like-minded ones. It's a powerful sense of refuge and of literally aligning our heart, our consciousness with our aim, the aim to draw in, draw out these powers of divine abidings and draw out the liberating wisdom within. You know, Dhamma has these various meanings of the truth, of universal nature, liberating wisdom. It's just a Pali word, Dhamma. But it implies, as Michelle was saying yesterday, a truth regardless of religion and philosophy and belief systems. Dhamma is whether or not there are Buddhas. And when Siddhartha Gautama was born, there was no Buddhism. There are many forms of practices, Jainism and various Hinduism traditions, still long before Islam and Christianity. And he himself, as I was saying yesterday, was a rebel against convention and imposed belief systems and philosophical dogmas. And the hierarchy of religion in those days held, you know, in the Brahmin class, you inherited spiritual authority, didn't earn it, and that was part of which he felt there's a truth beyond language and beyond belief systems, beyond religions, and that's what took him on his path, arduous path, and first body denying, and then body balancing, and the approach of the middle path. Balanced body, emotions, and mental faculties. So how can this be? You know, what is this? Where is this truth that is pointed to by many of the practicing living wisdom traditions? The 60s set a lot of us on fire in that way, and I spent 6 years in Hawaii and on the mainland and in Asia, trying all kinds of practices. In fact, many of them came through Hawaii as a crossroads. Many of the Asians. My first teacher in the 60s was a Tai Chi, was a martial artist and herbalist, Su Yao Pang, and he taught these various forms called Ying Yi and Pa Kwa and Tai Chi, and they all came out, you know, in the years that I was with him. I first went with him to learn the martial art of Pa Kwa and Ying Yi. And only when I was sick did I learn he knew acupuncture and herbs, because then they came out, you know. And then a year later, other arts that he had known, he came from China with. And he, in a way, was my first teacher, because he'd see me studying all these books, you know, on mysticism and Christian contemplative practice and East Asian contemplative practices and whatnot. And I'd carry them around, you know, kind of proudly, and wanted him to see and notice me and so forth. And then I was once showing him this book by Sri Aurobindo, this great Indian saint. And so he looked interested, and he was looking at what I was showing him, and I don't remember what it was, what I was trying to get him to comment on, but in a moment he just turned his head in a quizzical way and caught my eye, you know, in that way I've been talking about, and a mentor who sees our goodness even long before we know we have it. And he just said, the Indian word, Hindu word moksha, is a word for liberation. He just looked at me, caught my eye, he said, "There is no moksha." And I was so excited about this passage on liberation. So there is no moksha. There's only now. And I put my books down, you know. I didn't stop reading them or collecting them, but it helped me approach the search in a different way. And it was followed by my first Hawaiian teacher. She was trained in the Kahuna tradition, but uniquely, she also traveled to India and learned from Hindu tradition and especially a Buddhist tradition. So she combined, you know, the elemental spirituality of Polynesia and Hawaiian intuitive knowing, elemental knowing, and nature's way of knowing our spiritual core with what she would bring back from Asia. And she, you know, she was just a source, an embodiment of some of these Brahma-viharas, especially metta and mudita, joy. And I was telling a yogi today that another teacher, a third teacher, I met her when she was 90 years old. And she was a, you know, Southern California Christian mystic. And she was just who she was. She was just she was an entity of her own, you know. I met her when she was 90, and I was her student till she was 97. I just remember power and clarity of her blue eyes, and how she felt the whole universe would come right through her windows at night alone to show her the truth of things. You know, her attunement, her sort of cosmic attunement. So she was really unique. And, you know, eventually I came across this Vipassana tradition from Burma. And the reason why it instantly felt like a root living practice tradition for me, the reason I felt at home with it, is because it didn't deny anything else that I had been, or anyone else I had been studying with or about. It seemed to integrate it all, synthesize it all, and validate it all into a very powerful, practical, an immediate way of understanding, of bringing all this out of the intellect, you know, and into a vivid feeling understanding. So that was that, you know. And I never turned back once I found this particular lineage. It was years before I met the one of the main heirs or lineage holders, Mahasi, who was my teacher's teacher, because of the difficulty of getting into Burma. But still, I practice, as I've mentioned before, with friends who knew the technique and how to teach aspects of the practice. Until I stumbled upon my teacher, not really looking for a teacher. So it's valuable to, appreciate that it's not in the language. The Pali words that we're using are so because, like Hawaiian, it was a living oral tradition. It was never put down in words until centuries and centuries later. So Pali was a vernacular, spoken vernacular, in the area where Gautama, the Buddha to be, lived. And then it was memorized by these brilliant nuns and monks around them who had like this capacity for photographic memory, detailed memory. And why, if you study some of the discourses or suttas, you see they come in cadence and repetition. It's a way of holding that memory. It was 3 or 4 centuries of transmission in oral manner before they began scribing them down. They take a pointed piece of metal and put it in a fire and burn in letters on palm leaves in Sri Lanka. That's why you see, even today, the Sri Lankan script, Burmese script, is rounded. Because if you had tried to make straight lines, it would cut rather than going to make the more indelible circular types of script. If we get that, it helps us sort of sidestep potential blockages from the familiar. Like we often use the Pali words just because there's not an adequate word, or there's just a lot of association with the word metta or the word the word love or joy, where the meaning is quite profound. And it takes quite an articulation, a poetic cluster of wording, and delivery, to make sense in English of the potency of what's meant in Pali. For example, there's 27 Pali words for desire, and most of those desires are healthy desires. And we hear teaching so much about, non-attachment and desires that cause the suffering and whatnot. It's so simplistic and throws us so off, because both the word for dukkha, means so much more than suffering, as Michelle was saying last night. And desire is only a few entangling desires, or what I call insatiable desires, desires that just keep feeding on themselves. It's never enough. And rather than filling legitimate needs, it's just a cycle of neediness that's never fulfilled, a cycle of wanting that just makes more wanting. There's just a few of those kinds, and the Buddha's teachings point to them so that we can understand them. We can feel that thirsting in the body, and the difference between the kind of thirsting that can never be quenched and the kind that can. Yeah. The desire for liberation, the desire for unconditional love, to be love and be loved, that we've all had from time immemorial, and all our ancestors before us, is quenchable. Otherwise, as the Buddha said, he wouldn't have taught what he found. If there wasn't a freedom beyond just the cycle of desire and entanglement, and then more desire and more entanglement, if there wasn't a perfect peace, a perfect connected non-attachment, and a path to that, a middle path to that, a balanced one, he wouldn't have taught this. He wouldn't have taught these teachings. An example I love to give about the restorative nature of our practices, that is how we just create the space for it. It happens. And if we're lucky, it happens if we don't read a single wise word from a book or hear anything from a tape, or if there's no teachers in front of us. And then and the example came from a good friend of mine. He's an Australian monk. And he was a hippie traveling around Southeast Asia in the 70s. And around 1977, he was in southern Thailand and expressed a desire to meet his friend's teacher, his Thai friend's Thai teacher, Ajahn. Ajahn is a name for a respected teacher in Thailand. And his friend kept saying, "Okay, let's go, we'll go, I'll take you." You know, but it was always tomorrow. My friend was a little nervous. He had long hair, and he saw that, the monks had no hair and wore these strange dresses and stuff. And he thought, "Wait a minute, do I really want to be face to face with, what felt quite intimidating and attractive at the same time?" But finally, he said, "Okay, we'll meet in the morning at 8 or 7. 7 in the morning, it's appropriate time after they do the alms rounds." But he woke up early and kind of snuck out of his guest house, thinking he'd go down to the beach and escape another, opportunity to meet his friend's teacher. But his friend knew him pretty well by then, so he was there waiting for him, and took him to the wat. The wat is the Thai word for temple. It was one of those water drop connection meetings, instant connection, reciprocal kind of recognition, teacher to student, student to teacher. He stayed. Before long, he ordained as a novice, like a young monk, where you don't take all the rules yet and just sort of learn the ways of the monkhood, and how to wear the robes and whatnot, how to behave and show respect and just some basics. And then in a year, he took a full ordination. And then he began, sort of seriously following the way. You wake up at 3:30 and you go on alms round at dawn and just start to follow and internalize this ancient 2,600-year-old tradition. And then he began being interested in meditation. People would come by. This was a popular wat back in those days, and people would drop by, and he started to hear of this famous teaching monk, Ajahn Buddhadasa, in another wat up north, Wat Swan Mok, where I had spent some months myself a few years later. Okay, he started to hint to his teacher that he wanted to go visit this province where this wat was, although he didn't mention the wat or the teacher, Ajahn Buddhadasa. He just said, "I'd like to go to Surat Thani, and I think you have family there. Perhaps I could bring them some gifts or presents, And, monks often don't say anything. And he just heard that and went on with his business, and he mentioned it a second time. And then the proverbial third time, he suggested he go to Surat Thani province and take some gifts for his teacher's family. And so his teacher looked at him and said, "Tejo Namo," that's his name. "Tejo Namo, what do you want?" And he said, "Well, I want to go and learn meditation." He said, "Well, why didn't you tell me?" This is like after a year in the monastery. "We'll meet tonight at the old teak Dhamma hall. And here's the keys, for the gate. We'll be by ourselves since it's an old, sacred meditation hall." So at 6, Tejo Dhamma was there and excited, ready to learn meditation. And they went in, and they were the only ones in this beautiful old silent hall. And they sat from 6 to 8 o'clock, and not a word was spoken. 8 o'clock, teacher got up, and they locked up. And every night, that's what they did for 2 years. No instruction. And Tejo Dhamo said, "After a while, you just go through it all. You just see it all, you know, and you get bored with your own boredom, and you get tired of your restlessness, and you just somehow overcome your doubts, and you know, like the mind knows how to regenerate itself, the heart knows how to come into stillness by itself. It needs no religion, it needs no language, it really needs no verbal teaching. I mean, that's how the Buddha did it. After first getting a lot of teachings and excelling at them, and then being asked to teach with the teachers he was with, and they were all powerful practices, and generative of very subtle, nuanced states of consciousness. You know, jhanas, like what they call cosmic consciousness or God consciousness or whatnot. But he felt it wasn't completely free. He still felt ego in there, identification. He didn't feel really the end of the roots of greed, hatred, delusion. And so that's when he, you know, looked for another way. And as you recall, he remembered how when he was just a boy, that fresh, joyous oneness. And he felt like only from happiness, you know, can we enter that state of knowing, that deep state of knowing beyond personality, beyond life and death. So of all the kind of teaching stories, this one to me evokes like what I finally got from my teacher after getting really good instruction, and I trusted him so much, like I'd never trusted anyone before, so I just did everything he said, and you know, honed all the ways of practice and you know, moving through the different capacities to understand body, feelings, mind, and phenomena, and senses, and so forth. And then one day I came in for an interview, and his instruction before I left was two words: do nothing. And my response, you know, was panic and okay, well, should I just go back to the breath, you know, or just abide, you know, in this loving kindness or the senses, or whatever I said, his response was do nothing. And it was about 3 days of that. When I'd come in, I'd been trying to do nothing. I was just dragging my, you know, rag of tears and coming in, and he just said, looked at me and just said, you know, hold on to nothing. And finally, I got it, you know, and I just sort of, I let go of everything. At a point, you let go of the teachings, the teacher, the tradition. Just let go of everything, the whole system, you know, all the package that comes that with teachings. Of course, we're lucky to have these instructions, and without them, and without the ordained sangha of nuns and monks who have transmitted, memorized, and transmitted these into the time of writing, and you know, who takes this great care and respect to protect original teachings in a time when they're so easily assimilated, and they just start to spread out and get diluted in culture, and they become items unto themselves. You know, in many cases, quite helpful. All the ways mindfulness is used in our culture, really quite helpful. But out of the context of the liberating path, it's very different. You know, mindfulness in pain clinics is essential for people to learn to live with sort of incurable pain. But mindfulness in the context of the path of liberation and understanding and transcending, going beyond the known, you know, is very, very different. And it attracts other powerful, associated, skillful states, which include these four Brahmaviharas. Joy is one of the most crucial ones because it has to do with that part of ourselves that feels bereft of having our goodness mirrored. You know, all our issues of unworthiness, self-loathing, not being good or good enough, and not being valued, are the first thing that this joy starts to feed. far enemy of joy, envy and jealousy. You know, envy is when we don't want someone to have what they have, and jealousy is wanting to have what they have. And that is what's rooted in feelings of unworthiness and worthlessness. When we start to kind of open up to this pure joy that abides within us, we start to give it some space, and we start to feel safe enough to let it emerge and have the feeling tone of it in the body, it's one of the first things that starts to uplift. Maybe we start to feel jealousy and envy in our lives, in our imagination, in our fantasies, in our mental proliferation, in other yogis, in ourselves even, our capacity yesterday versus today. It's comparing mind in a way. Jealousy and envy is the way that our culture has taught us to measure, compete, control, compare, and so forth. And it's a burden. It's just really tiring, you know. To think, to have those kind of thoughts, to have thoughts controlled by those energies of comparing and competing and analyzing and the jealousy and envy and division that causes the fracturing to our system. So those waters of mudita, unbridled joy, just pure happiness for no reason at all, you know, and taking delight in other people's joy. That's why it's called also appreciative heart, appreciative consciousness. Because we don't appreciate very easily. We compare, we measure ourselves against it, or more poignantly, we have envy or jealousy. So to allow that appreciative, empathetic joy out and truly take delight. You know, just remembering the little boy or the little girl in us coming home with our watercolors and showing it to whoever's at home, our dad or our mom, you know, and sort of needing that healthy pride, that glint in the eye. Oh, that's such a beautiful watercolor. You know, we're doing that while Pasha was here every night. Before he goes to bed, I'd sit there with him and watch him watercolor. You know, and you pour your sense of worth and value and goodness in things like that at that age. And you just need an affirming, wow, you know, that parental pride. Instead, the parent talks about themselves, what they're going through or something, issue on their mind. And it's like the paper, it's just a piece of paper. You know, there's no poem or painting. And that's one of those times where we close up a little bit, we contract, we enfold and cover with a numbness or our fantasizing mind or powerful intellect or anger, fear, rage, all protective measures kind of build up that way. And, you know, eventually, whether we can articulate it or not, it's a kind of betrayal. You know, so what's supposed to happen between people, between friends, between children and parents, is this transmission of you're good. You're not only good, you're really good. You're good for no reason at all. You don't have to do anything to be good. You know, you're just really good. And to get that message again and again in so many different ways. For a bit of the 70s, I was living in Sri Lanka, single parenting our two-year-old, and we're living on the edge of a village, or edge of a forest, in a friend's guest house. So we had become like family. And Chandra came running out of the jungle one morning saying, "Daddy, Daddy, there's a mad elephant running out of the forest." You know, so I was a fairly decent, affirming father. And I saw it was like, you know, a poem, a water painting. I was saying, "Oh, cool, Chandra, you know, that must be awesome. What does he look like?" And about that time, I hear this tremendous crashing and trumpeting roar, you know, of an elephant. And I go behind our house, and indeed, it's a crowd of people in dust in the midst of them, this massive, tusked elephant running out of the jungle. And he's And he's within a couple hundred meters of the main road into Kandy. We're living in the hill province of Sri Lanka, the Kandy province. And it would have been disaster, you know, if he started running down the road into the village, into the main town. And there were, gangs of people would be picking up the chain that was on his left leg and wrapping it around huge trees, like big jackfruit trees. When you see chains and elephants together, don't be deluded. You know, if they want to go, it was just nothing. Those big jackfruit trees just went down, you know, or the chain just cut right through. Nothing would stop it. Until finally, the mahout, the young person who usually grows up with the elephant and is his best friend, catches up to the elephant, and you know, yells above the cacophony of sounds and noise and, you know, sort of terror and rage in the air. And the elephant hears him. And just at the road, the main road, the elephant starts to calm down and allows the mahout near to him, you know, and picks him up on his trunk, lets him on top. So the mahout can then, you know, regain the harmony of relationship with him. What had happened? Well, this is the temple elephant from the Kandy Temple of the Tooth. Supposedly has a tooth relic of the Buddha. And so it's just the sacred animal, you know, living at the temple, but it gets hired out to do work. And it was in the jungle, constructing some resort, something like that. And it had certain hours. And it had a just like a contract that we might have, you know, with our employers. It worked from, and it was from 7 to 11, and then taken down to the Mahaveli River for a bath and 400 pounds of lunch. The contractor was behind schedule and started to work past 11. So this went on for 3 or 4 days, you know. 11 came by, and 11:30, 12. About the third or fourth day of this, the elephant just felt completely betrayed. And he completely destroyed everything he helped build the past 3 days, you know, of his contract. And started running himself, just wild, who knows where, maybe for the river. Just angry, rageful. You know, that elephant lives within us. It's a cry for connection. It's the rage we feel when we feel betrayed, when we feel disconnected, when an arrangement that we trusted is broken. And it took all that the mahout had and years of relationship to reinstill that trust, that where, again, the elephant felt valued, you know, worthy of respect. This is when he will willing to work, and this is when he gets to bathe and eat. They stopped him working at 10:30 from now on. Extra hour at the bathing grounds. We can all relate to that, you know. We can all understand that. I mean, it's important to feel those feelings in our body and to understand that nothing wrong with rage, certainly when we understand it as a cry for connection, you know, and a call for reestablishing trust that's been broken. These Brahma Viharas, in particular, I mean, they all work together. Remember, you can't. When one's up, they're all up. But the particular gift of the mudita is this restoration of our sense of innate worthiness, just of being, that unbridled, like, passion for life, childlike oneness with life, not for anything we've done or anything we've not done to deserve it. We deserve it just for the fact of being. And this mudita restores that. The near enemy, it's good to get familiar with too, because it masquerades as that kind of joy, and we can get entangled that way. And this is where our teachings can help illuminate and illustrate what may look like mudita joy. It's some kind of joy with a hook. It's like Yes, I appreciate your joy. I appreciate your success. I appreciate your accomplishment. I take delight and feel joy in your joy. But, and that but is, we want something. We want a piece of it. You know, we want to, if we help that person's joy, we want credit. If the person just suddenly, you know, won the lottery or something, we're so happy for your joy, you know, and you know, we need a meditation center, and maybe you want to come and look at our land. And you know, I so appreciate that you have all this wealth in your life now, you know. But this, but and you know, or even just feeling important when someone is feeling so successful or accomplished in their life, so good, just wanting to be in that. You know, and there's a legitimate need. There's a legitimate want, a healthy desire to let some of that rub off. We get that around good teachers. And it's just to understand where the legitimate need turns into an insatiable neediness, where there's really a strong attachment there. That's attached joy. That's attached mudita. It's a fake mudita. It's not that unconditional delight. In wherever we see happiness, joy, success, like the trembling of heart that karuna is when the heart wants to care for or protect wherever there's anguish or discord or anxiety or suffering, the mudita heart dances in resonance, in celebration with wherever we see a joy, the song of a bird, you know, the leaping of a gazelle, the smile, you know, on a friend's face. In fact, in practicing this in the more formulaic traditions, we start with ourself or a benefactor for metta, and for karuna, we usually choose someone who's currently suffering in some way, but not too close to us, where it's easy to slide into grief, and not too distant, you know, that we can't feel some traction there. So someone who's in some way going through a hard time, physically, psychologically, spiritually, emotionally, or even someone who's seems to be doing really good, but we recognize with our wisdom that their actions are going to lead to suffering. All those can be in the category of a healthy, primary karuna or compassion subject. For mudita, it's really easy. You just think of someone you care so much about. There's no question of ever feeling doubt or comparing or jealousy or envy. Just thinking about them makes you smile. And thinking about them enjoying happiness and success and accomplishment and being in a good place in their lives makes your heart sing. That's the initial mudita subject that gets it going. It starts to pull it out, you know, and then we abide. And then we become the subject, and then anyone else or all beings, so that it does move out that way. Abide and pervade. Upekkha. This is a good poem for the Brahma Vihara of Balance by Juan Ramon Jimenez. He writes, "I have a feeling that my boat has struck down there in the depths against a great thing, and nothing happens. Nothing. Silence. Waves. Nothing happens? Or has everything happened? And are we standing now quietly in the new life?" Feeling from that poem helps to remove us from what can feel like upekkha, equanimity, or its near enemy, indifference, disconnect. The near enemy of upekkha isn't sensitive. It doesn't have a caring sense of connection. And it's a kind of distancing, a numbing out. It's when we feel overwhelmed by what's, if we watch the news, If you're unfortunate to watch the news or read the news at times, I don't very much because that's what I would do, you know. I just fall back to an ancient habit of numbing out, you know. I want to know just enough to where I can put my heart and make a difference. And not be overwhelmed, because numbing out is a excellent and expedient survival strategy, you know, protective measure, just to not have to feel when it seems so crazy. And one thing about the information technology world is we learn what so immediately about so many things going on in the world, and it's not so filtered. When it's turned off, there's a lot of really good things. You know, where I go and where I travel and people I'm around and retreats like this, I have a lot of hope at what the goodness and the transformative power of goodness in people can do. You know, if I were only looking at the sensational that's broadcast through IT, I wouldn't feel that connection. I'd be really hard pressed. I'd really have to pull up my years of practices, you know, to overcome that, because it's just blasting moment to moment. Of course we numb out. Of course we disconnect. You know, of course we can pretend we're interested and listen, but our mind goes elsewhere. You know, when someone's telling us about their success, and we can't quite feel the joy, you know, that they'd like us to celebrate in their with their life. True equanimity is the cause for the most close intimate relations, the most intimacy, the most profound connectedness. All the other Brahma viharas are there, but it's because of the upeka Brahma vihara that we slide less and less into the conditioned kinds of, you know, demanding love, or drown in the overwhelm of sorrow and grief and the pain in the world, and feel the neediness so much to be around joy rather than to learn to cultivate the joy within ourselves. It's the equanimity that lifts us out. It's the equanimity that is able to handle these extremes, or this sort of fiction of opposites, so-called good and the bad, the pleasure and the pain, the praise and the blame, the gain and the loss. That's just every day. That's just every sitting, you know, every moment. Experience, if we look closely, has a feeling tone of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And if we're not mindful, there's bound to be attachment to the pleasant, and bound to be aversion or fear of the unpleasant, and confusion or bewilderment of the neutral. If we are present with mindfulness or metta, or the Brahma Viharas, pleasant is just what it is. It's pleasant. And of course, it's beautiful, and you feel it all the more. Have all the more of an intimacy with what's pleasurable and joyful and beautiful about the world when there's no attachment. Because hidden in attachment, of course, is fear of its going away and loss, which is inevitable. But without the attachment, without the fear, we can so touch that moment of joy and appreciate it with wisdom, knowing that that's the way the world revolves. There's a birth and death in every moment. And with the unpleasant, the same thing. There's this knowing that it's going to pass. And without knowing unpleasant, we can never touch compassion. You know, without knowing that there's pain in the world, physical and mental and emotional pain, how can we grow our hearts? How can we open, you know, to that tender and sensitive caring, and learn to protect ourselves and others? That's what makes equanimity allow us to be so close and so intimate with life. And also with that presence, neutral feeling is equanimity. Rather than just a neutral feeling that can be a disconnect, you know, or numbing out, or insensitive, or spacing, or bewilderment. Neutral feeling tone is upekkha, equanimity, just balance. We're there regardless. We're able to hold with that equanimous heart the joys and sorrows and the gains and the losses. And from that act, with great wisdom, our fierce compassion is necessary. In one of the birth stories of the lives of the Buddha, he's born in a heavenly realm. Deva is the Pali word for like these heaven realms. In the Buddhist cosmology, we've all been there many times. And it's just the result of expressing our goodness that we get to spend these lives in these delightful heaven realms where there's heavenly or celestial music and celestial sensations and celestial everything, you know, that's really delightful. So he was born in this particular Deva realm called the realm of the 33 gods and goddesses. And he's sitting on his throne, and lifetimes in these realms are like a couple hundred thousand earth years. So every couple thousand years, the throne glows when there's something going on in the world, something really good or something really bad. So he feels it heat up. Saka is the name of the god of the 33. And his throne glows. So he knows something's up on earth. So he uses his psychic vision, you know, to look through the realms of existence down to the earth realm. And the first thing he sees is black smoke. And he sees people without enough food and children crying and not being cared for and old schools crumbling and armies fighting and rivers polluted and discord everywhere and elders not being respected. And it's an awful time on earth. And he thinks, I'll try to make a difference, you know, motivated by compassion. And so he transforms himself into a forester, all dressed in leathers and bow and arrow and so forth. And beside him is his favorite being, Big Blue, this giant, fierce dog who looks so mellow and tame one moment, but you know, if he knows that he has to be protective, his eyes glow like coals and his nose breathes flames. So he got really excited. He knew they were on a mission, so flames came out and coals glowed from his eyes and heat from his, you know, growling, snarly, toothy mouth. And they went down through the realms. And they peered outside this huge gate, this protected castle. And the sentinels were there. Who are you? And Saka says, well, I'm a forester, as you can see. And this is Big Blue. And he let out, you know, dragon flames and burning coal eyes. And the sentinels froze, and they quickly ordered all the gates to be shut, the four corners, or the four sides of the castle grounds. But in the same moment, they both leaped over the wall effortlessly and landed in the village square. And all the people gathered around, you know, shaking and frightened. And the king and the queen were up in the tower looking down, you know, what's going on? The forester's silent for a long time, and everyone's gathering around and feeling this, looking at this dragon-like blue, midnight blue dog, and, you know, what's up? What do you want? And the forester, Saka, says, Big Blue is hungry. Well, no problem, you know, yells the king and orders all the food from the morning to be brought, this huge, big pile of food. And Big Blue just takes it down in a gulp. Forester says, Big Blue is still hungry. So all the food of the last few days and the future few days, everything that's in the castle grounds is brought up, and it's a, you know, it would be enough food to fill the lodge. Big Blue just gulps it all down effortlessly. Saka says, Big Blue is still hungry. And the king and queen, they order everyone to go out, you know, all around quickly with all the carts and oxen carts and gather all the, you know, fresh grains and corns and fruits and vegetables, everything, until there's this mountain of food filling the entire grounds of the castle. big blue whoosh, takes it all in. Like he's not satisfied, you know? It's like that insatiable thirst and need. Nothing will do. Big Blue's still hungry. And the king and the queen and the ministers, they all plead. What do you want? You know, I mean, we've given you all the food. It's we don't understand. This dog doesn't seem to be satisfied. Are you going to eat us? You know? And at that moment, the forester begins to transform back into his rainbow deva body, Sakka, and said, Big Blackie wants to consume all your corruption and all your pollution and all your betrayals and all the ways that you haven't been caring for each other, your elders, educating your children, taking care of your environment, you know, cutting down your forests. He wants to consume all that bad energy, you know, all that avarice and greed and ill will and delusion. And they started to kind of rise up slowly, you know. And Big Blue, his flames kind of cool down, and he puts out this energetic blue vibe. Everyone starts to feel really peaceful. And they recognize that the forester was some kind of deva, some kind of god. But they're so shaken up by this event and the fierce compassion that these two figures presented, Sakka the forester and Big Blue, that they really did transform. And back up in the realm of the 33, Tavatimsa, back on the throne, Sakka looks down and sees that they're improving, you know. A few minutes go by, as few years in earth time, and he sees that everything is improved. And he smiles and pets Big Blue by his side. That's a good example of, you know, connection, compassion in its fierce mode, and making boundaries with a really pure motivation. And, of course, after the transformation, the joy you can take in seeing the change and celebrating people's goodness. And the equanimity, the really cooled out mind that is so intimate, so close, so attuned. Upeka is an attunement with things as they are. It's not thrown by what's alluring, attractive, by what we may want. And it's not intimidated by what's repulsive or seemingly, you know, attacking. It's like what I call bamboo mind. Its strength is in its vulnerability, in its hollowness, in its ability to yield and yet be firm. It just comes back to balance, no matter how wildly blown this way or that. It comes back to center. Just before one of the last times I was allowed in Burma, the monk that we teach with there, last 15 years, we've been holding these retreats called fusion retreats. It's East and West fusion. It's ordained monk and lay person. And as Michelle's been teaching that retreat, male and female, and tradition and contemporary, you know, because we keep trying to relanguage and present the teachings in ways that are relevant to our psyche and ways, emotional presence and so forth. So this fusion retreat is just get two for one. You know, you get the original transmission as it's passed down by monks and nuns for 2,600 years. And you get it also through seasoned Western teachers who are able to present them in relevant ways and relanguage them. The Sagain Hills is where this monastery is, and it sits on the edge of the Irrawaddy River, one of the great rivers of the world. And the hills are about 15 kilometers north to south and maybe two or three east to west on the west bank. And they're ancient, like 2,000 years of practice there. There's caves, old and some in ruins and some restored and so forth, thousands of caves, maybe 700 nunneries and monasteries. all Buddhist spiritual roads in some way or another lead to the Sagan Hills. Because when you start going back in lineages, everyone has a teacher who practiced there in one of those caves or monasteries. So one of the last people I was fortunate to meet, because he was 103 and he wasn't there the next year, he'd passed away, was maybe a few kilometers along the river north and then into the Sagan Hills. There are these enchanting hills. You can easily get lost in them because they roll and they seem to change as you move about, and turn and curve, and just an enchantment of Dhamma. So we arrived at this glen of an old monastery, and it was quiet. And this really ancient monk was in his room, and it was like walking into light. It was quite a while before I realized he was completely blind and barely able to hear. And yet he wanted to know who each of us was. And so his attendant had to yell very loud in his ears each of our names until he got it, Stephen Smith, magnified 10 times. Hawaii, until he could feel the name. And then he would take my hands and I'd feel his hands. Take my hand with both his hands, and then I put my hand too. And this is maybe 10 years ago. And I still feel the feeling when I think of him. And the feeling was his warm, cool hands. The warmth of metta and the coolness of equanimity, or the warmth of joy and care, and the coolness of balanced, serene mind. And then we were there for 2 or 3 hours. I don't remember what we shared. And when we left, it was the same. And the touch of the hands, the taking of the hands, and the feeling of that cool warmth or warm coolness. And then he gave a blessing to each of us. It was like a blessing and a transmission teaching all in one. Very simple. In one line, and it says it all for these teachings. May you be free of even one unskillful mind moment. Coming from his depth, his profound liberation, connection, joy, equanimity, and understanding. May we be free of even one unskillful mind moment.